Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, our guest is actor, director, writer, and Berkeley resident, Matt Ross. Ross is well known for his role as Gavin Belson, the villainous CEO of a Google-like company called Hooli on the Emmy Award-nominated show Silicon Valley on HBO. Who is Gavin Belson modeled after? It is sport, of course, in the real Silicon Valley to guess the inspiration for each character on the show. And tonight we'll hear from the Bay Area's own Matt Ross about how he created the character Gavin Belson, who he looked to for inspiration, and given that he lives close to Silicon Valley, how his portrayal is received there. Despite his successes in front of the camera, Ross is also acclaimed for his work behind the camera as a writer and director of last year's Oscar-nominated film, Captain Fantastic, for which he won a directing award at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Captain Fantastic features a father and his six kids who live in the wilds of the Pacific Northwest, completely insulated from modern life. And when circumstances force them to interact with the world outside, tensions arise between the father's idealism and the children's ability to manage the world at large. It's about how parents can be flawed and be loving, how they can make bad choices for their kids and be educated by the consequences of these choices. It's a complicated and very moving film and makes you curious about what inspired Matt Ross to write it. So without further ado, Matt Ross, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And we'll open those phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. If you have a question for Matt Ross about either Silicon Valley or his movie Captain Fantastic, we want to hear from you. So, Matt, you work in the entertainment business, and you've been involved in a number of hit shows and celebrated movies, but yet you live here in the Berkeley, in the Bay Area, which is sort of unusual for us to have an actor based here. Can you tell us a little bit about your career path and how it is that you ended up living here and working down in Los Angeles?
Sure, yeah. Although I'm not sure how unique it is. I mean, famously, obviously, Robin Williams lived here. There are a handful of other
Francis
actors.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes,
definitely. We have our entertainment
presence
here. Yes,
it's close enough to Los Angeles. How I ended up here, primarily, if not entirely, because of my wife, who was raised here, and she wanted to raise our children here, really, and I did too. We met in New York. We lived in Los Angeles for a year, and at the time there was an opportunity. A family home came available. It was an apartment at the time, and our daughter was, I think, 2 years old, and we, as an experiment, wanted to see if we could make it work, and we've been making it work since then.
And you have roots here on the West Coast. You're from the Pacific
Northwest? Yes, yeah. I'm from Oregon, yeah.
And so I assume that being in Berkeley, is that very different to you from where you grew up? And
oh, yeah. It's very, very different. Mm-hmm. But I feel very close and connected to the West Coast. You know, I went to college in New York and lived there for 10 years, maybe almost 11, maybe 11 years. And, you know, you get to a certain point in your life where you're making decisions about where you want to settle. This was before we had kids, but certainly a lot of people I knew who were older than me, whether they're having kids or not, they start talking about, you know, you first make the move to, although now everyone lives in Brooklyn, but back then people still actually lived in Manhattan. People move to Brooklyn and then they start moving to upstate New York or out of the city and putting down roots in that way. And I think for me, I felt like both of us actually felt like we either wanted to live in the city or we wanted to go back to the West Coast. And then when you have kids, obviously everything changes because you want them to be near their grandparents and have them be part of their lives.
And so, logistics-wise, how do you make that work, working in L.A. but living up here?
Very painfully. I would love to have a high-speed rail like they have all over Europe, Western Europe.
We've done a show on high-speed rail.
Can we please
before?
Have that tomorrow? That would make my life much easier. So I have a Prius, and I drive, which is probably not the best to do for expanding my carbon footprint, but it's an electric car, a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is it's I do it for a couple of reasons. One, because you know, though it is a 3-hour trip door to door on an airplane, it's a tremendous hassle of waiting on other people's schedules. And when I drive, I'm able to kind of just have 5.5-6 hours by myself in my car and time to think. And I listen to a lot of podcasts and a lot of books on tape. And sometimes I just drive in silence for 6 hours.
Now, I was going to ask you how you make use of that time. I mean, you'd use it to prep for the show or just to give yourself a little bit of that space?
Well, when we're shooting, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can memorize pages and pages and pages, or, you know, you just sort of do the scenes in your head while I have that time to myself to do that. Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, I should back up, since we talked about that you're born in the Pacific Northwest or raised in the Northwest. How it is that you even got into acting in the first place? We can tell a little bit about.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's hard to remember because it was so many years ago, but I made little short films when I was a kid. My grandfather either had or bought me a Super 8 camera, and then I started making them on video when video was introduced. But I made a bunch of terrible short films. Most of them were reenactments of Star Wars or whatever you make when you're 11 years old. And then at the same time, I started acting in local theater when I was in junior high. And I did a lot of theater. A lot of theater as a kid. I lived deep in the woods in southern Oregon, but at one point we lived in Ashland. And so I started doing theater as a kid there.
With the well-known Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, there's a real strong theater presence.
Yeah, and I was both at the festival, and also there was a troupe of young actors that were largely the sons and daughters of actors or directors of the festival who wanted to be in plays or do plays. And a guy named Paul Barnes through the education department, he worked in the education department at the time, wanted to direct. He's now a director. And so he kind of got these kids together. We did sort of, you know, kid Shakespeare. And that was the beginning. And I did that. And then I went to New York. I went to Juilliard. At the time, it was a decision between going to film school or theater school. And at that point in my life, I think I was very unsure about my abilities as a writer. I still am unsure about my abilities as a writer. But when I was that young, I certainly felt like a fraud, especially because I had grown up doing a great deal of theater. And it's not just Shakespeare, but Shaw and Chekhov and great American playwrights like Sam Shepard or whomever that I admired, people like Tony Kushner, and, you know, that was later. But, you know, people I really admired, I just thought, I don't have anything to add. Certainly as an adolescent, I didn't feel like I had anything to add. And theater was, there's an infrastructure, you know. So when I graduated then from Juilliard, I went to NYU for 5 seconds and took a film class there. And that was really my only formal film education. So did that answer your question?
Well, just curious how you made the transition then from theater into television and film, where you're at now.
As an actor?
Yeah, as an actor.
Well, I lived in New York City, and that opportunity is available to you, that opportunity being theater, whereas I think if you go right to Los Angeles, it's much more difficult. There's Los Angeles is largely a film and television community, and there is some theater, but I don't think it's appreciated the same way it's appreciated in New York City, which is still, you know, the theater center of the U.S. So making a transition there isn't really a transition. You're a freelance hire, and whether it's theater or film, I came, you know, certainly coming from Juilliard, which is a classical theater education, you're available. And you're available for that. And you have the skills for it. I did some theater, some regional theater, very briefly, but I realized early on also that I didn't want to spend my life outside of the city, meaning I didn't want to job out all over the country, because I was conscious of wanting to be in film and television, and I did want to be involved. And at the same time, I was writing those things, and I wasn't really writing theater, and so New York was my base.
And so was your first transition into television, was it with HBO's Big Love?
No, I had done as a series regular. Yes, I think that was the first thing I'd done. Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'd have to look at my resume. I don't remember, but I certainly
need
had
to
done,
Google yourself.
Yeah, I'll need to. I'd certainly done a lot of TV shows, 1 hours where you're a guest star. You know, I'd done that. I shouldn't say a lot. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I lived in New York City. The majority of the work I did was film. And it wasn't really until The Sopranos, which changed the landscape of modern television, and opportunities like Big Love became available for many people. At that time, it was mostly network TV, which I frankly wasn't that interested in. It wasn't really the kind of acting I wanted to do, though I auditioned for it. I mean, you know, at that time when you're young and you're anyone who will pay you to act is it's great.
Sure.
Fantastic.
So then you transition from HBO's Big Love, and now you're on Silicon Valley. And, you know, kind of going back to your Berkeley roots, you're on the road a lot. Can you talk a little bit about what the logistics of the travel and the shooting schedule is with that? I mean, how much time are you on the road down there? What's the schedule like, and how much time you spend here?
It's different every week. Silicon Valley specifically shoots between October and February, and during that time, I'm back and forth constantly. The part I play, Gavin Belson, you know, he's not one of the five main guys in the house, so in any given episode, I may have between one and four or five scenes. Scenes are shot, for people who don't know, don't work in the film business, you know, you shoot scenes depending on the location, so if all the scenes I have in one episode are in my office, then they're shot on a single day or 2 days, right, depending on how long it takes to do that. So I may only work in a given episode 1 to 2 or 3 days. In which case I'm, you know, driving down there a couple days before and driving home as soon as it's done.
And you're probably in a unique position in the cast, because I imagine most of them are probably based in L.A. or at least not anywhere near
Silicon
Valley.
They are now. I think some of them lived in New York when they were cast, but yeah, everyone's in L.A.
But given that you're close to the place where the show is based on, do you get recognized locally more? Do you have more people coming up to you and talking about tech?
Oh, you know, fire alarm.
Yeah, I apologize. We've been doing fire alarm testing, so we're going to have to transition to a quieter studio. I apologize to the listeners.
Let's do it.
Indeed, we are experiencing some fire drill testing here at the studios of KLW San Francisco and the Sala Burton High School. We're going to bring our guests into our main studio. It'll be a little bit quieter, but thank you for bearing with us here at 91.7 for City Visions as we transition into this other studio. This is KLW San Francisco, and this is only a test of our system. We're going to get you right back to our conversation with Ethan Elkind. Here we go. Hold on 1 second. Let me get our microphones in the proper positions, and we'll be all set. Gentlemen, you were saying...
All right. So I was just asking Matt about how much he gets recognized here locally by Silicon Valley folks, given that you're actually based here near the place where the show is set.
I think in San Francisco, I feel like I'm recognized more than I am in Berkeley. But you can kind of tell if someone recognizes you and they work in the industry and they work in tech, there's a different enthusiasm. It's slightly more passionate than because they, you know, they're seeing themselves or versions of themselves or their coworkers. And as opposed to someone who just watches the show as a fan and is not in the industry. But I don't think it's, no, I would not say that percentage wise, it's greater in the Bay Area than it is in, let's say, New York City. I mean, I walk down the street in New York, and it feels like every 5 seconds, you know, or, you know, it's also that happens a lot more when the show is on, right? You know, I mean, HBO is a massive channel that is constantly has many, many shows. And when we're on the air, I think you get recognized a lot more because people saw it the night before and they remember your face. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, for those who aren't familiar with Silicon Valley necessarily, can you describe a bit about your character, Gavin Belson?
Sure. Gavin Belson runs a company called Hulu. He's the CEO of and founder of the company.
Or Hulu, right?
What did I say?
You said Hulu.
I did?
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay.
I watched Hulu last night.
Yeah. Hulu is a great way to watch television.
I watched Top of the Lake on Hulu last night. There you go. Hulu, which is, you know, I think it's a fictional company that's modeled probably on companies like Google, mass tech companies, massive tech companies. And he's I don't write the character. In my estimation, that I hope he's someone that you kind of love to hate. That he's someone who's, you know, you described him earlier on as villainous, and I suppose he certainly does function as a kind of antagonist toward Richard, the main character. He's constantly thwarting his plans or trying to buy his company or steal his company. But I think there's a kind of there's something human about him that makes him, I hope, not a mustache twirling villain. You know, I think that he's very empathetic and very sensitive at the same time that he's kind of monstrous.
And was that your approach, or is that what the creators of the show came to you to sort of have you play him that way? Because you do bring a humanity, a sincerity to him that's not just a mustache twirling villain, as you said.
I don't know the answer, but I think that, you know, long form television evolves, meaning that they have an idea about a character, they cast an actor that they think is closest to their idea, and then depending on what that person does or can do or adds, it may morph. So I don't know if it was the chicken or the egg. I know that in the beginning, I remember trying to play him with a great deal of humanity and talking to Mike about that. But I don't know that that's why he cast me. You know, I don't know what, you know, at the time, I'm not sure that. You know, of course, in the beginning, they've written a one-hour pilot, so they only have 1 hour of story. They don't know where the character... I mean, they may have an idea, but they don't know exactly where the show or the characters are going to go. So you're kind of all in the same boat.
Well, and your character on Big Love was a pretty sinister character, and do you think that was sort of a thought there?
Not in terms of my casting, because Mike had never even seen Big Love. Huh. So, you know, I always say that being an actor is like you have to reinvent.
Mike Judge, you're talking about.
What did I say?
Well, you said Mike. I just want to make sure for listeners, I know it's Mike Judge.
Mike Hulu. Yeah. Mike Judge, yes. Mike Judge, the writer and director, you know, he was first got a great deal of recognition from writing the cartoon, I think, was on
Beavis and Butthead,
but then went on to make many movies, including a comedy masterpiece called Office Space.
Yes, and Idiocracy.
Idiocracy, which turns out to be a documentary.
Should have been called Nostradamus.
Extremely gifted gentleman. Mm-hmm. What was I saying about him?
Just that he had not seen Big Love.
Oh, yeah, he hadn't seen Big Love, so he didn't see Big Love and say, oh, this guy's great at playing bad guys, I'm going to have him be a bad guy. I think, you know, I originally had read for Peter Gregory, which is the part that Christopher Evan Welch played, who was sort of my nemesis, or I was his nemesis on the show originally. I clearly failed at that part, did not do any of the brilliance that Christopher brought to that part. And then I was cast as Gavin, and then we've talked about it sometimes, but a lot of it isn't. A lot of our work isn't really about your. I want you to be similar to this person. Go study this person. It's more. I guess he's a fictional character based on maybe some people they've seen in the Valley. But frankly, he's never said to me, "You're this a little bit of this person and a little bit of this person." I just came in with a take on it, and then. A lot of what I do and how I behave, if not entirely, is based on what the scene or the show demands. Mm-hmm. So
there was never an instruction that this is a Steve Jobs character.
No, never.
And so did you look to Silicon Valley to find a model, watch YouTube clips of Peter Thiel or, you know, some of these Silicon
Absolutely.
Valley?
Absolutely, yeah. I read his, I think it's an autobiography. Teals.
Zero to One.
Yeah, I read that. I read the biography about Steve Jobs by Isaacson. Is that correct?
Yes, Walter Isaacson.
Yeah, Walter Isaacson's book. I read a handful of books. I certainly looked at YouTube videos of a lot of speeches by, you know, CEOs of tech companies, a handful of people. Mm-hmm. But I never made the attempt from the original audition onward. I was never trying to imitate any specific person. I wasn't doing anyone. This was not, you know, like, I think certainly maybe they could weigh in on my costume or my hair and say, you know, who has their hair like this? We want you to do that. But they didn't say it to me. You know, it wasn't say like, you have this person's hair, this person's, mm-hmm. you know, wardrobe. That was never clear to me. I mean, I was.
You mentioned Christopher Evans Welch, who passed away tragically, as you mentioned. He played Peter Gregory, who was, as you say, your nemesis. So, what was that like? I mean, obviously, from a human, you know, element, that's, you know, it must have been really wrenching for the show to have that happen.
Yeah,
but from you, from an acting perspective, I would think that would put a lot of sort of put you into a difficult position now if your character, in a way, was originally set up to be the sort of nemesis of him. Like, how did you have to kind of reevaluate how you're going to approach the role?
I didn't have to approach my role any differently, but it was certainly a huge it caused the writers and, you know, the showrunners to have a huge recalibration of, I think, how they envisioned the forces of antagonism toward the main characters. I mean, you know, we're talking about a human death, so all this is just it's meaningless. What's meaningful is the fact that, or this, that, you know, what's tragic is that Christopher died. But he was an actor on a show, and he played a certain character and had a certain function. And then I think they had to then pivot and say, how are we going to deal with this? I think that it was shocking to me. It was shocking to everyone else. In fact, I think I had worked with him. I want to say like 6 or 7 days beforehand. We had worked together in New York on a TV show 10 years before, so I kind of knew him a little bit. He was very involved in Seattle theater. I had a lot of friends from Seattle who knew him from that world. We had been to a couple read-throughs together of the show because, you know, you read each script beforehand so the writers can hear what's working, what's not working, and HBO can hear what's working, what's not working. And so I had said, oh, we had this back and forth across the table, like, we're going to get to work together. It's going to be fun. And I think in the pilot we had – God, I don't even remember if we had a scene in the pilot. I know we were both in the pilot, but I don't remember if I had an actual scene with him. So we're finally getting up to this big scene, and we had that scene. We spent the day together. And then a week later, I had heard from a friend of mine who was on some social media that I'm not on, and said, you know, he died. And then I think they dealt with it with a great deal of respect. And the show is primarily a comedy, and they dealt with it in a comedic way rather than trying to navigate around it. I thought they kind of dealt with it head on in a way that I think I don't know him enough to know whether he would have appreciated it, but I think it honored him in a lovely way. And I think they cleared it with his family and said, is it okay if we do this? And,
well, I know they said, some of the interviews I'd read with the writers, that they had talked about, should we reshoot some of the scenes since he had passed away, essentially, while you're still shooting.
Yeah, he did.
But I think it's a real tribute that they kept that in there. It's fantastic work. And for listeners who haven't seen season one, it's really an amazing performance. So I'd encourage all of you to check that out.
He's on another level.
Yeah. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is actor Matt Ross, who plays Gavin Belson on the HBO show Silicon Valley, and also the writer and director of last year's award-winning movie, Captain Fantastic, which we're going to get to in just a bit. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments for Matt Ross. Do you have questions about his portrayal of Gavin Belson or about the ideas behind Captain Fantastic? The number to call to join the conversation, and we'll open the phone lines, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@KALW, or reach us on Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. So we hope to hear from you with your questions. So I want to talk just a little bit more about Silicon Valley, because the show obviously closely tracks what's happening in the real Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And how much do you follow Silicon Valley news and use that to influence your portrayal?
Well, I do follow what's going on, not religiously. I mean, I follow it, I think, more as a consumer, you know, as just tech is part of all of our lives. You know, I'm looking around the room here and there's computers everywhere, and, you know, we're all on our phones and iPads and our apps and it's how we navigate the world. And so as a consumer, it's part of my life. And, in terms of what's going on, in terms of the news of the Valley, I only really address that or come in contact with it through the show. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the writers every year do a bunch of research trips, and I think they're trying to get ahead of the curve every time, which is difficult. And and a lot of the things that have been depicted on the show are based on real things that have happened, some of which are famous, and some of which are less known, but. There's a great deal of due diligence that goes on. But that's, you know, I mean, I'm not an author of the show. I just memorize my lines and don't bump into the furniture.
Yeah, memorize them on I-5 while you're driving.
Yes, exactly.
So, all right, we've got a caller, Steve from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Great show, and that's the only show that my wife and I will watch together.
Oh, great.
We make an appointment every Sunday. So I hope you'll tell us when it's going to be back with new episode. Matt, what you do is a great thing. I'll make an analogy to sports. It's easy to watch a guy with the ball and he's doing a dribbling or he's doing a big thing. You do a great job when you're not speaking. when you're on the receiving end. And it could just be a little tilt of your head or an eyebrow or something.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Can you speak to us and tell us kind of where you picked that up and what your skills that you're able to increase from being a director also?
Well, thank you for that. That's very sweet.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, I think, you know, there's the cliche about acting is reacting, and I think that's what you're alluding to. It's how people react to what's given them, which illuminates the story. So I think I'm certainly conscientious of that. And in terms of directing and how directing has influenced my acting, I think from the very beginning, because the beginning of my film career was with writer-directors, and I always felt like they are the author and my job was to fulfill their vision. And I'm very conscientious of that as an actor. It's like I want Mike Judge and Alec Berg, who are the showrunners, when they're happy, I'm happy, because I really am, you know, I'm singing certain notes, and they're the notes that they have written, and I want to make them happy. And part of that is just giving them as many variations of the ideas we're discussing in any given scene, so that once they get into the edit, they have options. Because, you know, you might think, well, you need to be yelling at him at this moment. You're actually very upset. But you then, once you see it, you realize, you know what, we just had three scenes where there's yelling and we didn't see that or notice that. Do we have any other variations? And if you give them that, if you're able to play, then they can then have you sing a different note. So directing has certainly taught me that, you know, because the editing is the second time you write it, and I try and help them, help them go into the edit with as many choices as possible.
All right. Well, that's a great job, and we enjoy it.
Thank you.
Over here, and it's kind of great fun.
Great.
Yeah, thank you.
It's good work, man.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thank you, Steve, for that question. I wanted to follow up with another question around Silicon Valley. We talked about the passing of Christopher Evans Welch, but we also have another character change coming up for the fans of the show who've caught up on the last season, and hopefully everyone is on listening in. T.J. Miller, who played Erlich Bachman, who's also kind of your nemesis, too. So you're kind of like the drummer for Spinal Tap here. You're having some actors that you're not able to kind of bump up against. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of how that came about? I mean, I read an article with him where, you know, he had some pretty critical things to say of some of the folks and very positive things to say, too. And he felt like his character had sort of run its course. But can you tell us a little bit about that and what your plans are going forward, at least from an acting perspective?
There's two questions there. The first thing about TJ, the truth is I really don't know. I mean, I'm not privy to what, you know, that's between TJ and the writers of the show. I think that, you know, I'm taking it at face value that I mean, I think there's a couple things going on. I think TJ maybe felt like he has more opportunities in film and, you know, in his film career at this moment. And also I think that they were maybe running out of story and felt like that character had served his purpose, which, you know, it does happen. I mean, that happened in Big Love. There were characters that had much bigger parts in the very beginning because of the way the structure of the story. And as the story continues in other directions, characters are written out or, you know, actors cut. That happens a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think it was I assume it was kind of a natural progression, but I really don't know. And then your last question was about me and TJ?
Yeah, I mean, how are you sort of gearing up for this next season, knowing that?
Well, I don't know.
You left him in China, actually.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, certainly his absence will create a certain vacuum and will influence the show in certain ways. But again, as someone who doesn't write it, I show up the first day and read and, oh, we're doing this, or the show is going in this direction. I assume that will influence the guys in the house far more than it will influence me because, you know, we were not adversarial. I mean, I think that as characters, you know, TJ's character, Erlich Bachman, I think would have been very happy to work at Hooli if, you know, as my right-hand man, if I had, you know, presented that opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so for all you know, Jin Yang, one of the characters in the show, may go back to China and rescue him from
this opium den that he ended up on.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is actor Matt Ross. But before we get to that, I want to welcome City Visions' regular host, in addition to me, or co-hosting, although we don't actually ever get in the studio very much, so it's a real pleasure. We have Joseph Pache here in the studio to talk about KALW and how we can rely on your support to help keep this program going, keep shows like this on the air. Joseph, welcome.
Thanks so much, Ethan. I have to say, listening to this program on the way over here, I want to give the two of you such kudos for just keeping it going despite all of the ambient noise.
We appreciate that. A fire drill is always fun.
Ending.
Yeah, live radio. What better than that? 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org are the two ways that you can show your support for programs such as this one and stations such as KALW.
You can help us pay for soundproofing.
That's great. We do have sprinklers, right? 1-800-525-9917.
Don't tempt fate, Joseph.
Or KALW.org. And this is your opportunity, a new member Monday, or as sustaining members, to show your support in this our fall membership drive. Ethan, you've been with the show now for two years?
About a year and a half, yeah.
It feels like more.
It's been
in
great.
In a good way.
It's been a lot of fun. And, you know, this fire drill we've had tonight, it's a good example. It's a live show. We were able to bring you this programming so we can keep this conversation going with the listeners of the Bay Area. And this is a time where, you know, we really value your support to keep the kind of programming like this going and to be able to put on these live shows so that you get a chance not just to hear something pre-recorded, but, you know, ask people like Matt Ross and other guests that we have your questions.
Yeah, and local programming that is really varies in its content. Being able to speak to people like Matt Ross, hearing from innovators in the Bay Area and people who are have their finger on the pulse of where the next big thing is going and how the Bay Area is leading the charge. And you get to hear that here on KALW, but specifically here on City Vision. So show your support tonight by clicking on KALW.org or dialing 1-800-525-9917. Now let's get back to your conversation with Matt Ross.
All right. Thank you, Joseph. So, yes, we have Matt Ross, who plays Gavin Belson on the HBO show Silicon Valley, and also the writer and director of last year's award-winning movie, Captain Fantastic. We do invite you to call in with questions or comments. And the number to call to join that conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Also, you can feel free to email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So let's talk about Captain Fantastic, because that's a movie that you wrote and direct.
Yep.
And it's a really fascinating film. I put it on in order to get ready for this for this show, and I thought, I'll just watch the first 45 minutes, and I'll probably get tired, and I'll, you know, cause I usually watch TV before I go to sleep, and right, maybe watch the next part. And I could not stop watching it.
Oh,
it was absolutely riveting. Good. I thought it was one of the most original films I've seen. It had a really fascinating kind of political philosophy, and yet at the same time it was very much a movie about families and parenting, which certainly I could relate to with my children. So I think there's a lot there for viewers to really get a lot out of. So I congratulate you,
Thank you.
That achievement. But I want to just hear about how that movie came about. How did you come up with the story, and what's the birth of Captain Fantastic?
It's always hard to remember the exact genesis of something, but I think, well, clearly I was processing being a father. My daughter's 14 now, and I wrote the movie when she was younger, and I have a 10-year-old son. And I was thinking a great deal about parenting and looking at my friends who are parents. And it's not something that you really, as Viggo said, there's no book that teaches
Viggo
you.
Viggo Mortensen.
Yes, Viggo stars in the film, plays Ben Cash, the father in the film. You know, he always says there's no book to teach you. And it's true. You know, you're sort of, I mean, there are many books about parenting, and I've read many of them. But, you know, it's different depending on the child. And that you know, parenting, as any parent knows, is kind of an hourly recalibration. You try certain things, and it works or it doesn't. And every child is different, and every stage is different. And I was just thinking a great deal about parenting and what my values are. And I was aware of wanting to write a film that I thought reflected a little bit about our greater culture as well, because I think the film is a specifically American film. I think every culture has its, you know, it's every country and every culture has its advantages and disadvantages and issues. But this film, I think, for me at least, it was me grappling with being a parent in the United States today, and certain things that come up, whether it be technology or schools, other people's other parenting styles.
Well, and there's obviously that strong fatherhood, parenthood theme to it. Mm. But there's also this kind of fascinating dynamic where this family is living essentially out in the woods.
Yeah.
And I gathered you grew up in a sort of alternative community.
Yeah.
How much did you draw on that background to create this portrayal?
Well, there are many things that are autobiographical, but that really isn't one of them. I mean, there are some things like, yes, the family in the film lives in a teepee, and at one point in my life, we did have a teepee, and we'd spend the summers in it, and it was up by a lake, and I did live in a very isolated place at one point in my life where we were, I don't know, 5-8 miles from a cement road and something like 30 or 40 minutes away from the general store and about an hour and a half away from a town of 1,000. So we were really far in the woods. And that's similar to the family. But it had much more to do with the math of the narrative. You know, I knew that I wanted to sort of tell a transformational journey about a father who starts one place and ends up in another. And so you kind of deal sort of in extremes. And this was an extreme form of of parenting where, you know, the film is very much about a couple who have given up their careers, their professional lives, to devote every waking moment to their children. And that's an extreme thing. I mean, I think it's admirable, but there are some repercussions, and the film sort of discusses that.
Yeah.
I think what I was going to say really quickly is that only afterwards did I realize that the journey of the son, the eldest son, Bodovan, who's played by George Mackay, was probably the closest autobiographical element, insofar as I remember feeling like a freak, really feeling like we lived in the middle of nowhere and we were unlike most people. Even the kids that I went to public school with in the town that were, you know, they were country kids, but they didn't live the way I did. And so, and the need to leave that community was palpable.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you mentioned one of this character, Bodovan, and there's actually an audio clip that we have of Bodovan, if I'm
correct. Yeah, this is George Mackay.
Okay, so you mentioned the name of the actor, and did a fantastic job in this film. So this is a clip, it's a scene that features the eldest son, Bodovan, who's about 18. He meets a girl at a campground that they stop at on their trip. He obviously has no experience with girls, it's so incredibly awkward. And the scene provides some comic relief, but it also it has a little bit of a squirm factor. So the scene starts when they're interrupted by her mother, and let's listen to the audio on that.
Right, he kisses with, okay, go ahead.
It's almost midnight. I sincerely hope you two lovebirds haven't been doing what I think you've been doing.
I know what you think. But I know that your daughter has taught me many things just now. She has broadened my mind. She has helped me grow. When we just kissed for the first time just then, the endorphins that your daughter sent through my body were like dolphins swimming through my bloodstream. The way she has opened me up, she has penetrated deep inside of me, and I know that I have penetrated deep, deep inside of your daughter. And not like that. I would love to, when is necessary, for I want kids someday. Not right now, of course, but when you're ready, when I'm ready, because I think this should be a shared decision. This is a decision that we should make together. But when you are ready, I will be ready. I am ready for you. If you will have me. Claire.
So some funny dialogue in there, but a little, you know, it's unusual to see these kids who have been off in the woods and now they're coming in contact with real teenage stuff. So was that fun for you to write, or was it slightly painful too? Did you have to draw on that, what you were just talking about, or that inspiration?
Well, we actually moved to a town way before something like this would have happened to me. No, I mean, it was certainly fun, you know, and George brought a great deal to that. In fact, George is English, and at the time he was on holiday with his parents in Italy. I think they were in Florence, and his callback was via Skype. And he was very there was two scenes that I had that character audition for. That was one of them, and there's a scene about college letters that, if you've seen the movie, comes later, and it's a difficult scene as well. And I asked George, I said, look, you know this pretty well. Why don't we just kind of improvise around it a little bit, and you can add your own spin to it? And that bit about dolphins swimming in his bloodstream, or endorphins, was his bit. And in fact, that was the moment where I really knew that he was very he wasn't stuck on a performance style, and that he could play, and that's really what I was looking for in the actor to play, that someone who could explore with me, because I think that really, you know, when people say directing is casting, that is true, and that's part of my point, but it's also, I like to personally create an environment where the actors aren't really supposed to or required to deliver a performance between action and cut. It's not a play. They haven't had 5 weeks to rehearse it. So let's play and let's dig. And that takes you have to want to do that, because sometimes people come and they've decided what they're going to do beforehand, either by themselves in their trailer, or they've worked on it with a coach or whatever they've done to prep, and they want to deliver that particular performance. And I think that's a version, but I like to dig deeper. And when I saw George was able to do it, it had a lot to do with why he was cast.
Well, and you had six children and to direct, which I imagine is a challenge. How did you prepare to be a director for children? Did you have to talk to directors about what that's like? Or?
No, I think, you know, kids are hard, but they're not difficult in any of the ways people think they're hard. The truth is that unlike adults frequently who have an idea about what they're doing or should, kids don't, and so they really show up to play and to have fun, and that's only a problem when they're not concentrating, when they're screwing around too much. But that doesn't happen, you know, a lot. It's like, guys, come on, let's concentrate. But that's a minor problem. The problems with kids and the younger ones really is the things like blood sugar levels. Like, they need to go to the bathroom and they don't mention it until they're in pain, or the youngest ones are crashing and they need an apple. You know, things like that.
So probably being a father prepared you better. Exactly. Than another
and to be fair, you know, their parents are there, or a parent is on set, so you know they have guardians that are there, they're taking care of them. And we also have a legal guardian that's mandated that's there to watch them, and so I don't have to do that. But that's the hard part, is concentration. Acting takes a great deal of concentration, and you really have to manage their energy levels. But they're not difficult in any other way. They really want to play. They want to have fun. They want to explore. They want to try it a bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. It's really just patience. That's all it is.
Well, you coax some great performances out of them. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guest tonight is actor Matt Ross, who plays Gavin Belson on the HBO show Silicon Valley, and also the writer and director of the movie we've just been talking about, last year's award-winning Captain Fantastic. We do invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@KALW, post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. You can reach us by using at cityvisionsKALW. So we have an email from Victoria who says, the film draws a line between, quote, natural parenting, letting kids run wild, follow their passions, be off the grid, etc., and, quote, plugged-in parenting with technology and social media, etc. We actually have a clip we'd love to play demonstrating that dynamic. Mm-hmm. How have you straddled that dichotomy as a parent?
Wow, that's hard. That's a really that's a hard one that I think every parent is dealing with in a way that our parents didn't have to deal with. I mean, when I was a kid, it was always about how much TV you're watching, right? And it was just, and there was, you know, TV was, you had to watch a show when it was on. You know, now kids have iPads and iPhones, and I think the film posits a family that doesn't live in the world, right? They're removed from the world. And on one hand, that's much, much more difficult, and on one hand, it's much easier, because I think it's, in some ways, it's far more complex to live in the world and decide to teach or try and teach your children to navigate around these technologies that, frankly, I see most adults failing to navigate. You know, I mean, there was some short film floating around the internet a couple of years ago, and it was all about, it was just showing people on their phones all the time, and it was very funny and very wise, and it wasn't even a satire, it wasn't even parody. It's true. Yeah. And if you're in a coffee shop or waiting for the bus, how many people are actually reading a book? Most, if they're reading a book, they're reading it on their phone or on a Kindle. And so, if, you know, and I actually think that's really, it's deeply sad. You know, I see people walking their dog and they're looking at their phone, or, you know, or walking down the street and looking at their phone. You know, we're no longer present. So if adults are having problems navigating that, how can we help our kids? Yeah. And so that is when you ask me how I do it, it's you know, we made a choice. My daughter, I think, was the last of her friends to have a phone, and we made a choice to allow her to be part of that. You know, a lot of them do their homework together on FaceTime, and you know, they're sharing the way that we used to call each other up on the phone and do homework together. Now they're doing it, and so you know, we've made a choice to allow them to be in the world, but we're also hoping to teach them. And it's a constant struggle, constant struggle.
It's kind of an interesting irony, perhaps, that you're on Silicon Valley, this tech show, and that you've done this film
that really
grapples with those technology issues. But let's go to another audio clip that I think illustrates this this challenge about parenting differences. So this is a scene that presents two radically different views of parenting. In one scene, Ben, the father, is visiting his sister Harper and her family, and Harper's kids are playing video games and watching violent movies, which is not an illustration of perfect parenting, perhaps, but she nevertheless challenges how Ben is taking care of his kids. So let's listen to that clip.
How are the kids doing?
They're strong.
How long you been out there?
Wherever it is you're living now.
We left Boulder when Bo was three.
And then we were on that farm we had in Oregon until he was eight. So we bought the land in the forest 10 years.
How do you still have money?
We only buy what we need.
Look, Harper and I have been talking. The kids need structure, stability. They need to go to a real school. So they can get real jobs.
Christ, you're gonna get them killed. Sorry, but your kids are without a mother now. I don't think you have any idea what you're doing to them.
I'm saving their lives. That's what I'm doing.
Ben, you sound so ridiculous.
Is knowing how to set a broken bone or how to treat a severe burn ridiculous? Knowing how to navigate by the stars in total darkness, that's ridiculous. How to identify edible plants, how to make clothes from animal skins, how to survive in the forest with nothing but a knife, that's ridiculous to you?
Jesus.
They have the cardiovascular and muscular endurance levels of elite athletes.
Who cares? They're children. They need to go to school. They need to learn about the world.
It's a pretty powerful clip that I think in a lot of ways gets to the heart of the philosophical differences in the movie. Whose side are you on in this scene?
Well, first off, that was the great Steve Zahn and Catherine Hahn with Vigo. Well, to answer that question, I'll say this. I think there are many Americas within the United States of America. I think that the film tries to show three of them, which are a kind of a rural America, a suburban America, which is frankly most of America, and then there's a kind of at the end, the grandparents, played by Ann Dowd and Franklin Jella, are kind of a conservative and wealthy America. And it was always our intention, all of everyone who works on the movie, the actors, everyone, to show each of those Americas with nuance and humanity and integrity, and not to vilify anyone. So I think that they all make good points. You know, I hope that you see the film and you can decide for yourself where I stand. I think that you know, some of them exist in extremity a little bit. I don't think Harper or Dave were the two voices you just heard other than Vigo, the characters. I think they're excellent parents. They're doing the best they can. They probably both have jobs. They're barely making it by, making a living. And so I think that they're dealing with the stresses of their lives and their own misunderstanding or lack of understanding of how he's living. And they make valid points. They do. I hope that,
Well, how do you respond to criticism that this movie would feel different if the father was a right-wing survivalist instead of a left-wing survivalist that might be targeted to a more liberal audience? I mean, in this case, the character, you know, celebrates Noam Chomsky Day and espouses left-wing views. Do you think the movie would work as a right-wing survival tale too?
I suppose it depends what his intentions were, because I think, you know, my response to that is, yes, it represents my particular politics, but I don't think the film is political. I think that the people that he's mentioning are intellectuals who traffic in facts. So as long as we're trafficking facts, I think it doesn't matter what the politics are. And so if, you know, I mean, I have some friends who actually are very far on the right who saw the film and they responded as a father and they were not alienated by his left-wing politics, you know.
And the acting performance that Viggo Mortensen gave as a father netted him an Academy Award nomination. And why don't we go to a clip of Viggo Mortensen basically kind of in action as a father in this character. He's on the family bus, which is named Steve, which I think is a great detail. And the father is driving them to their mother's funeral. And so he asks one of his daughters what she's reading. So this gives you some insight into his parenting style. Yeah, let's hear it.
What's a bordello?
A whorehouse.
Oh.
What are you reading? Lolita? I didn't sign that book.
I'm skipping ahead.
And?
That's interesting.
Interesting!
A legal word!
Dad, can't you say interesting?
Interesting is a non-word. You know you're supposed to avoid it. Be specific.
It's disturbing.
More specific.
Can I just read?
After you give us your analysis thus far.
There's this old man who loves this girl, and she's only 12
years
old.
That's the plot.
Because it's written from his perspective. You sort of understand and sympathize with him, which is kind of amazing because he's essentially a child molester. But his love for her is beautiful. But it's also sort of a trick because it's so wrong. You know, he's old and he basically rapes her. So it makes me feel... I hate him. And somehow I feel sorry for him at the same time.
So obviously a fascinating moment as a parent, great moment as a teacher, and he's really challenging his daughter to think there. Is this how you were raised? I mean, are you deliberate in doing this with your kids? What was your...
I wasn't raised that way, not specifically. I do, much to my children's irritation and aggravation, do behave that way. You know, when they see something or read something, I want to talk about it. It's not because I'm testing them, but I want them to articulate their thoughts, whatever they are. So I do challenge them. You know, I can only do so much, but and I think that, you know, that this, that moment in the film is really was there as an example of that. You know, it's like when you watch a film about someone, whether they're a great author or a jazz musician, and everyone talks about how great they are. Well, you kind of want to see it, right? And it's very difficult to do that. So we talk about a great deal about the parenting style being one of trying to nurture critical thinking. And I wanted to show an example of what that is. You know, it's not that they're geniuses. It's just that he's trying to teach them critical thinking. And what is that?
And with a real honesty about a difficult book.
Yeah,
too.
yeah, exactly, honesty.
And so Viggo, like I said, I mentioned that he got an Academy Award nomination for this role. Can you tell me how he became involved in the project?
In a traditional way, you know, I mean, when it came time, I didn't, when I was writing it, I didn't have anyone specifically in mind because I think that's kind of dangerous. You just don't know who you're going to have access to. And even if you have access to people, you just don't know who's going to be available. And a lot of the actors who can green light financially films are very busy. So when it came time to cast, he was my first choice, and there was a bit of time where we had to sort of wait for him because he had some other jobs lined up and he couldn't do it, and then when he was available we made the film.
So you weren't thinking Lord of the Rings when you were
No, I love those films, but I mean, frankly, the performances that, if people haven't seen Indian Runner, he's brilliant in that film. I think Eastern Promises and History of Violence are also recent examples of, you know, fantastic, nuanced characters.
Also, The Road, which reminded me of this part a little
bit,
of a very intense fatherhood, protective kind of a role.
Yeah, he's brilliant in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was it like working with him? And I mean, how much direction were you giving him? How much was he really inspiring you in terms of putting the performance
together? Well, it's a
two-way
street. You know, I mean, when you invite an actor, you're basically saying this person is now you and nothing you can do is wrong, and I'm going to be here to reflect on what I'm seeing and push you in different directions that maybe you haven't explored. A lot of it is that. It's like I like to back up and let them find their way and you know, the first couple takes, you're kind of, everyone's sort of finding what they think the scene's about, and then once he gets cooking and he's happy with what he's doing, then I sort of push and pull him in other directions. I think this can be speeded up, or I think you're missing something here. A lot of how I direct is really just, here are some other ideas that we haven't maybe explored.
Mm-hmm. And actually, on the subject of this film, we have a tweet from Michelle who says, "I loved Captain Fantastic. The ending, not that we want to give that away, has become a touchstone for me, a reminder of the wisdom of taking a middle path." Thank you, Matt Ross. She writes.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle, for weighing in on that. And I have to ask, where does the title come from? Is it the Elton John album?
Well, certainly there is an Elton John album called Captain Fantastic and the Dirt Brown Cowboy, which my mother had. And I have said this many times. I didn't know of it. I wasn't referencing that particular song or that album. And if you look at the lyrics, which I've done consequently, they have nothing to do with the film. There was something, it clearly hit me at some point in my life and was deep in my hard drive, and I like titles that are enigmatic, that are lyrical, that have some poetry to them, and that don't tell me exactly what the movie is. And there was something about this. I think it's pretty clear to me that he's trying to be kind of fantastic captain of his family. I think that's sort of clear, but maybe only after you see the film. But it was not a reference. I was not referencing that album. I'm not denying that it exists, but it wasn't a seminal album for me that I was, that I was riffing on.
Yeah. So we've got about a minute left. Yeah. I'd love to know what's next for Matt Ross. What do you have on tap?
Excellent question. I am, well, Silicon Valley starts our next season in October, and we'll shoot that until February. So that's next for me. And I'm also writing a couple of different films, and hopefully one will rear its head and say, make me next, and be good enough to do so.
Mm-hmm, great. Well, we're very proud that you reside here in the Bay Area, and we hope you keep up the great work. And you can watch Matt Ross, if you didn't get a chance to tune into the whole show, of course we'll have it archived, but you can also watch him on HBO Silicon Valley and hopefully in a movie theater coming soon. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight, actor, writer, and director Matt Ross, who plays Gavin Belson on the HBO show Silicon Valley, and also the writer and director of last year's award-winning movie Captain Fantastic, that we've been able to talk about at length tonight. Thank you so much for joining me this evening, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we discuss the history and art of the Mission District here in San Francisco. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.